Our third case for this morning is, I'm not sure how to pronounce this, Cuff against Teamsters Local 301. You can tell us how to pronounce your client's name.
Cole, Your Honor.
Oh, okay.
Thomas Cole.
What's your problem with the English language?
Morning, Your Honor. My name is Marty Dennis. I don't think there's any dispute in this case about what the standard is in this case. This is an ERISA case. It's a procedural denial case. The statute is clear. Section 1133, it says you have to give adequate notice in the denial letter. The ERISA regulations say the same thing. You've got to tell them the reason. It can't be conclusory. You've got to tell them the section of the provision that you're basing a denial letter on. And if the reason you're giving there's information that the person is lacking or the claimant is lacking to perfect his claim, his or her claim, you got to tell him. You got to tell him up front.
Mr. Dennis, what actually happened back in October, on October 3rd of 2005, if I'm remembering correctly?
Yes. Mr. Cole had gone back to work in June of 2005.
And
he comes into the office. He says, I would like a disability pension.
An oral request.
An oral request. The pension fund in their plan, section 6.5, says that you should. We're obligated to provide a form to you for an application. He wasn't given a written application, and October 6th, he is given a decision, and the decision says to him, you have not become permanently disabled while employed in covered service. That's the sole and singular reason he was given. 18 months later, after we filed the lawsuit in October of 2006, the defendants then came up with a second reason. And their second reason was you didn't have some type of SSA paper. And Mr. Cole, upon being notified of that, then went out over the next 3 months, called Washington, D.C., called the SSA office, went to the Kenosha office 3-4 times, wrote letters 7 times, personal visits, phone calls, letters from his attorney, asking, can I get this SSA paper? And they told him, look, you have a disability award. You may have a second medical thing, but we don't give it to you. We don't give it. We can't give it. We won't give it to you.
See, and that's why this case is so unusual, I think, because he did have, based on the 1999 events, Social Security Administration, that he was entitled to disability benefits, and the Social Security Administration gives him the opportunity to try to go back to work, which he tried to avail himself of, didn't work, and I gather throughout that period of time, since he didn't exceed the 3 months, he was still getting the Social Security payment. So you can see where all of this comes from. I mean, to be honest with you, I think if they didn't, you know, but if the trustees at the time the first letter came out had provided something that touched all the bases that this regulation 2560.503-1G requires, and in particular a description of any additional material necessary for the claimant to perfect, I'm not sure you'd have a case, but I don't see that additional material. And I can see why the Social Security people were confused, and they wind up sending this very cryptic letter on August 13, 2007. And then, as far as I can tell, the trustees just decide, okay, let's just essentially almost settle this case. Let's give the guy the 8 months, and now I guess he's on his retirement pension, right?
He was granted in September of 2008 8 months of a disability pension.
Right.
He was denied 37 months of a disability pension.
Right.
Going between
dating
October 2005.
Okay.
And the predicate, again, this court has said, Your Honor, Judge Wood, you said in 1983 in the Wolf case, in which
not 1983, I was a baby then.
you that was another decision you were involved in. you said, and that case involved where there was just a conclusion, conclusory, and that was insufficient. You said you've got to describe in detail what is needed. And if there's
that's what the regulation says. No, I think I'm telling you, I think that of all the things that you've said, your strongest point has to do with the lack of quality of the notice of the statement of reasons, because maybe you would have gotten something better out of Social Security, even though this is an odd request.
Remedy for that, and this court has said that over and over again. You said it in the Schneider case. You said it in the Schleybaum case, the Schneider case. You said it in the Schleybaum case in 1998 that the remedy for that is, and if the individual is entitled to benefits, which they have already decided, that he's eligible for benefits, is the remedy is to go back and to award benefits from the date of the denial. That's fair, that's equitable, because the plan engaged in a procedural violation of the law and the statute and the regulations, which resulted in a substantive harm.
Are they? Let me ask you about that. I have some trouble on the merits here, Mr. Dennis, because the plan is written in terms of become disabled, and the disability issue is delegated completely to the Social Security Administration. And as far as the Social Security Administration is concerned, your client became disabled in about 1998, and that never changed.
That's not correct, Your Honor. Social Security in 1998 found that he did become disabled in 1998 for one condition. After all his efforts, they gave him two letters, one in August of 2007, and ultimately they also gave him a second letter in September of 2008, which was before the plan, that said his disability dealing with his heart surgery, open heart surgery, was connected.
Sure, I understand that, but the verb in the plan is become, and he became and stayed disabled. If that's correct, then your theory would have us punish the plan because they decided to settle and go ahead and give your client the 8 months rather than decide afresh. No, we could just decide that he's not eligible at all.
At first, I don't agree that they settled. They were obligated as fiduciaries to construe the plan.
Well, they decided, in essence, we'll give him this much money because it's not worth fighting anymore, and we have to be prudent about our assets.
Well, I don't think that's in the record. But even going beyond
that, I thought
it
is in the record. I know I've read it.
Well, that's what they wrote in the decision, self-servingly on that. The point is they were obligated to give him notice at the time it mattered, and the time it mattered was in October of 2005 when he could have done something about it. But even going beyond that, your point with respect to the SSA award, the plan doesn't say SSA award. It says a certificate of insurance award. And the evidence, which was undisputed in the record, was you can't get that. It was impractical to get. It was impossible to get.
And the reason for that, let me just, it's a different angle on what Judge Hamilton's talking about. We see a lot of Social Security disability cases. And I want to draw a distinction between the condition, physical or mental, that is afflicting a person and the determination whether that person is totally disabled. The total disability determination is made based on an assessment of what your residual functional capacity is, whether you're capable of performing your past work, whether you're capable of performing any other work in the national economy. And it doesn't matter if one condition is making you unable to perform any work, or 15. I mean, if you can't perform, so at the end of the day, it's a functional assessment. So adding a second reason, even though this letter read favorably to your client, does seem to add a second reason, other orders of the nervous system, neurological conditions, that would have been subsequent to the heart attack. But the bottom line is still, can he work? And couldn't work before, he still can't work. And so I guess that's, if I'm extrapolating from what Judge Hamilton's talking about, that would be the concern. It may not help on the notice question, but it is the concern.
Well, if you look at what they said, and if you look at their minutes of their meeting on April 20 of 2006, the minutes of their meeting didn't say anything about having an SSA award. the minutes of their meeting expressly said, not in covered employment where he became disabled. That's record 38, exhibit number 10. They said in their first brief to the district court, record 37, page 5, the trustees determined that Coe had remained disabled prior to and through his efforts to return to work. That's a wholly separate reason. Divorced from having an SSA award or certificate of insurance.
That's the same issue.
It's not the same issue, Your Honor.
Suppose the letter had said, it had just had an extra sentence that said, you have been disabled since, you've been receiving disability benefits since 1999, and your effort to return to work was unsuccessful, so we're going to disregard anything you did with R&L Trucking.
That may have been helpful and informative with respect to the first letter.
About that.
Pardon?
There's nothing he could have done about that. He was getting Social Security benefits since 99, and his effort to return to R&L was not successful.
Whatever the reason they offer, you can't change gears in the middle of the stream.
That would be just a more fulsome explanation of what they said. You know, you didn't become disabled while you were in covered work. I guess he did become disabled because he happened to be working for a non-union company, right, at the time of the other on-the-job injury.
R&L Trucking was a union covered.
No. I'm talking about the 1998.
That was a non-union. You're correct.
Yeah.
He
suffered the injury that led to the Social Security benefits at a time that he was not in covered employment.
From 1999.
Right.
But his situation had changed.
I know he was trying to work for R&L.
Okay. I think my time is up. I want to reserve.
Okay, sure.
Thank you.
I'll let you reserve. Mr. Widmer.
Yes.
Hang on, Mr. Widmer. We'll let you walk up here.
William Widmer for the pension plan. The issue is whether or not the April 23rd 2009 letter awarding benefits from September 1 was arbitrary and capricious.
But I think the issue is also, given the background to that letter, whether the initial determination that he wasn't
eligible for
benefits complied with the notice requirements.
Vacated, and it was remanded to the trustees. But the language that you would like to see, I believe, is in the trustees' first decision letter. First, let me state that this isn't one of these cases like Halpin and the other ones where someone is on a medical disability, they're receiving benefits from anywhere from 4 years in Halpin to 15 in Legere, where they say you no longer meet the definition of disability. That's conclusory.
No, and what worries me about this case is you never spell out for Mr. Coe these four things that the regulation calls for, and in particular a description of any additional material necessary to perfect the claim and an explanation of why it's necessary.
The requirement is substantial compliance, and I believe that is met. I'm going to read to you from the final paragraph in the trustee's letter, and it went not to Mr. Coe because by then Mr. Coe was represented by counsel. It went to his counsel. Your arguments on Mr. Coe's behalf failed to address the fact that he has been receiving benefits on the basis of a permanent disability continuously from June 1999. Mr. Coe's status as permanently disabled has remained unchanged since December 1998, a time when he was not employed in covered service. In fact, his unsuccessful attempt to return to work confirms the correctness of that determination. Mr. Coe was found by the Social Security Administration to be permanently disabled at a time when he was not in covered employment. That status has not changed. The eligibility requirements are simple, as Judge Hamilton noted. We're out of the disability business. Social Security says you're disabled, you are. The plan says that in order to be eligible for a disability pension, you need three things.
What's the date of the letter you were reading from?
April 27, 2006, trustee's first decision, letter to Mr. Provenzano.
So it's long after this first notification, but you say we should set that.
Well, the October 5th letter Here's what happens. On October 2nd...
Wouldn't we have saved a lot of time if you had just told him that then? And
what he was told by the pension analyst was you weren't... Look, pension fund gets a phone call October 2nd. This is all in the record. This is Exhibit 2 to the agreed 56-1 statement filed second time around. And it's a memorandum of Mr. Coe's phone call. He calls in. He says he's working for R&L. He says he had to leave because of his back was hurting him. And he says he's still getting Social Security disability. They say, bring the pay stubs in. He does. They look at it. They know he's still disabled. He gets a letter. You didn't become disabled in covered service. You're not eligible. 45 in covered service, 5 years vesting, disability in covered service under 6.3. To prove disability, the plan must, as evidenced by, you must have a Social Security award. That's what the plan says. The summary plan description, same thing. And so they tell him it's not when the key factor you're missing is you didn't become disabled in covered service, it's not conclusory for me to say you're denied because you didn't become disabled. The trustee's letter then spells it out.
Let me ask you for a second, Mr. Widmer. Suppose we disagree with your view of the October 2005 letter, the initial letter. And suppose we say that's not enough to comply with 1133 in the implementing regulation. Are you trying to suggest to us that we ought to say that such a defect was harmless because, in essence, there was nothing Mr. Coe could have done to have persuaded you all otherwise because he remained disabled the whole time?
I think the short answer is yes. The somewhat longer answer is I think Your Honors correctly read the April 23rd, 2009 decision, in that the trustees thought that they would be protecting assets by paying the 8 months rather than taking the absolutist position, which I think is fully justified, that you were disabled, you are disabled, you didn't become disabled in covered employment, you remain disabled.
So I want to actually shift gears briefly, since you just mentioned again the 8 month payment that he gets from the trustees, and turn to the attorney's fees, because it seems to me 8 months of payments is some degree of success on the merits, and I don't see how he wouldn't be entitled to some fees under the Supreme Court's decision in Hart.
The reason is simply that is this. The remand, the 8 months in fees came from the remand. Hart makes it very clear that you are not entitled to fees if you are successful on a purely procedural matter.
But it's not a purely. He gets money. He gets dollars.
But he doesn't get
pocket.
The money as the remand in Perlman.
This litigation is he gets money. I know it goes up and down, you know, a number of times. But the Supreme Court says one should look for some degree of success on the merits. And
if you look,
he gets the 8 months, and I am.
Let's begin by looking at this court's decision in Perlman.
No, but in Perlman she fails.
But it's because it's a procedural remand.
But this isn't procedural. It's not like you get.
It was a 60B remand.
But he gets the money. Remand is 60B.
It's newly discovered evidence.
And then the trustees look at the newly discovered evidence and give him the 8 months of benefits.
But that was not as a result of any litigation. The trustees had a judgment in their favor. The judgment continued. And
then there's newly discovered
evidence. So you go, it's something, it's not as it, had that evidence been presented the first time, I don't know what the decision would have been. But it's a purely procedural remand.
Well, I'm not sure that that's consistent with what the Supreme Court said in Hart. I mean, it's a remand that deprives the trustees of the benefit of what they had won before, reopens things based on newly discovered evidence.
Is it reviewable? If you look at Hart, in every remand case cited by plaintiff, in their brief, in their reply brief. It is a reversal because there was a finding that either they failed to perform the regulatory duty, they abused their discretion, they did something wrong. The remand resulted in a reversal. That's the distinction between sentence 4 and sentence 6 in Social Security. In fact, the portion of the Shalala decision cited by plaintiffs at page 43 of their brief, pages 300 to 302, is where Justice Scalia spells out the sharp difference between a 6 remand and a 4 remand. A 4 remand is a decision on the merits. A 6 remand is procedural. Because what's a sentence 6 remand? It's evidence which for good cause shown wasn't, but should. I know you do. It's the same as a 60B, newly discovered. It's not on the merits. It's a purely procedural. And all of those cases, and I will, unless the court has something further, let me just state, all of the cases in their reply brief on fees are remands where there was a finding of an abuse of discretion, improper conduct, failure to perform a regulatory act. So it was reversed and remanded. In the Magistrate Denilo case, the Young case, there he found, because there were two phases to the litigation, phase one, the plaintiff established an abuse of discretion, they established some success on the merits. This is purely procedural, and Judge Zagel's decision should be affirmed.
All right, thank you very much. Anything further, Mr. Dennis?
Judge Wood, you hit the nail on the head. Yes, and you're both saying it. They should have said what they said later on, 18 months later, up front at a time it mattered, so that the claimant, Mr. Cole, could take diligent efforts to try to cure it, fix it, or perfect it.
How could he have cured it, though, going to Judge Hamilton's question, if my other comment is correct, that really the bottom line is whether he can work?
He did work.
But he didn't.
He worked in June of 2005 for several days. He suffered a heart attack while working. He underwent open heart surgery. He had two medical conditions.
What I'm trying to say, and I probably didn't say it very well, is for purposes of the Social Security Act, he was getting a disability pension, and the Act itself allows somebody to try to reenter the workforce and gives a window, but he did not manage to complete that effort. He wasn't successful in reentering the workforce. So as far as the Social Security Administration was concerned, as I understand the record, but please correct me if I'm wrong, he remained disabled the whole time, that is to say, unable to perform any work, as the administration defines
that. Based on the earlier 1999 determination, but the...
Based on his inability successfully to keep going for more than 3 months.
There's a letter that was provided by Social Security in September of 2008 in the record, which stated that it was connected to his June 2005 disability. That's was provided to the trustees on the remand. And the record, and that was in the record on the summary judgment. It was a September 18th or 5th, 2008 letter from Social Security, said it was connected.
That's the one that I was looking at in your brief a minute ago?
No, that's the August 2007 letter.
Okay, so there's a later letter.
Yes, there's a September 2008 letter, which the Social Security, again, not a certificate of insurance or a certificate award, but a much more abbreviated letter, which provides that information.
No, it's okay. If it's in the record, I promise you we will find it.
I also want to make the point that with respect to the issue of asking him to get a Social Security award or certificate of insurance award, which is impractical to get, again, case law, Third Circuit, the Eastman Kodak case says you can't do that. That's arbitrary on its face. Number two, with respect to the application issue, they denied him benefits going before September of 2008 on the predicate that he didn't submit a completed application. They never gave him an application. Your Honor and Judge Bauer also in the
Swipe
case said you can't create a condition and then and not adhere to it and then expect the claimant to follow it. Also, just as on the attorney's fees, that he was a catalyst. Thank you, Your Honor.
All right. Thank you very much. We will take the case under advisement. Thanks to all counsel. And we'll move on to